it's a bit hard to answer. The first word that came to mind as you asked the question is highly frustrated with not able to pursue my passion, really. Work has always formed a very core part of my identity and who I am. And I miss seeing meeting with young people and families and doing the best I can. But I'm otherwise okay. As far as health goes, things are fine. It's just the frustration of waiting for the processes of the regulatory systems in both countries to straighten up and clear, which is happening. Fingers crossed, by the end of May, I will be in a position and I can talk about it later in the interview.
Maya, why did you decide to become a psychiatrist? And was there a particular reason why you decided to focus on working in child and adolescent mental health services?
I was attracted to it quite early on in medical school, even, because I found that it sits at the intersection of medicine, psychology, and human experience. In terms of working in CAMHS, it felt important because I felt that, statistically speaking, about 75% of all adult mental health problems, and I'm talking about psychiatric disorders because I'm from a psychiatric background, the signs and symptoms are identifiable before the age of 18. And that's a huge statistic. Early intervention can genuinely change the trajectory of a young person's life who might be struggling with something like mental health difficulties. And it's one of the areas in medicine where careful ethical practice really, really matters, because the impact of getting it wrong can be long-lasting, in fact, lifelong-lasting. And so there's a real opportunity here to shape trajectories that would otherwise become much more difficult for individual young people, but also their families. Unfortunately, when the signs and symptoms are left too late, for example, psychosis, the longer you leave it untreated, the worse the outcome. It's all about collecting, collating, formulating, and then appropriately prescribing safely. And that, I believe, could happen a whole lot better than it is at the moment.
Tell me about when you started working for CAMHS, for Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services in Kerry in the Southwest. How did that all come about?
I was working as a locum consultant in Cork. In Cork, the teams are brilliant, and I found that all hands were on deck, and we cleared waiting lists. And there was interest expressed by specialist trainees who were finishing up to become consultants, who would otherwise may not have looked at this particular scene to apply for a job there. And I left with the team getting a permanent consultant from one of the trainees finishing their training. And then I moved to the other Cork team. September 7th, 2020, I moved to South Kerry CAMHS.
Maya, when did you first realise there was a problem in Kerry CAMHS?
The alarms went off in my head in the first two to three days, because I had an excellent NCHD.
An NCHD, that's a junior doctor, is that right? NCHD?
Sorry, an NCHD is a non-consultant hospital doctor.
So take us from there. When you were working with this excellent NCHD doctor, well, when did you start realizing the medication or the care and treatment of some of the patients, young patients at South Kerry CAMHS was not as it should be?
I was brought a set of three different clinical files of three patients. And the moment I looked at the three, I was speechless. There's no other way of putting it. The cocktail of medications prescribed to very young children in those three cases. And then I looked at some others in a series of seven cases, and I described them and I noted, the risks, the harms possible, etc., and sent an email to senior management, which was a very long email, but that was the start of it. So there wasn't a single point, single moment as such, but it was a gradual recognition. So from those case series of seven reported, then it was followed by the senior management team arranging for a random case note of audit of 50 more files. And an independent consultant was brought in, and that was finished in November, validated my findings and the risks and harms, the clinical harms from treatment and also some cases of negligence. Unfortunately, what I had, again, I'm going to use a metaphor here, is I had opened a Pandora's box, and for the next 8 months, I was furiously with my NCHD, just furiously correcting, taking people off stuff that they shouldn't have been on in the first place, and certainly not in those doses. And all combinations.
Can you give us some examples of inappropriate medication where there was a cocktail of medication being given to a child or a teenage patient and it was just not appropriate. It was excessive.
Yeah, I'll give you one of the first very early ones, actually. I think it was an 8 or 10 year old. Can't remember the age exactly, but I remember the case very vividly. There was no assessment on file, and yet a diagnosis of ADHD had been assigned. They were prescribed with ADHD. You start with especially in children as young as that, you start cautiously at low doses and then you build up one medication at a time in most cases. And this young person over time had been prescribed in the end 7 different psychotropic medications. And by that, I mean medications that act on the brain. There were 2 different types of stimulants, actually 3, 2 different types of stimulant medications for ADHD, where you usually prescribe one, and even that you start carefully. There was no physical health monitoring, as is mandatory by all international guidelines. There was a non-stimulant medication also added. So there were 3 ADHD medications for this young person prescribed and continued. And there were 2 different antipsychotic medications at low doses. They would be really used to contain severe persistent aggression that doesn't allow you to assess anything in a young person, because they have a side effect of tranquilization, and in low doses that is helpful because you do it for a maximum period of 6 weeks at a time, and the expectation from you is that as a child psychiatrist you'd be trying to work out with the MDT, the multidisciplinary team, the actual correct or the best fitting formulation for the young person, now that the aggression and the agitation, throwing objects, smashing the rooms, etc., is subdued and an assessment is made possible. The alternative in such cases is inpatient admission, which really is last resort. This young person had been on it for the previous 3 or 4 years and continuously, and also at higher doses. And then there was the sleep hormone prescribed, and the 7th drug escapes my mind.
What were the physical and mental impacts that child felt, that child who was 8 to 10 years old?
They seemed like they were on the autistic spectrum. The complete blunting of their emotional reactions, and the parents were concerned. They were concerned that their child had essentially changed dramatically from how they used to be when they were first referred, and not in a good way. Their symptoms may have been under control, but they were getting side effects. And the main one was this emotional blunting. And it's a very unpleasant state to be in. Adolescents will describe that state as feeling like a zombie. And I would agree that is an apt way to describe it.
Because the child had been given so much medication and inappropriate medication, the result was that child had been zombified. Basically, the character had been sapped out of them.
Yes. And unfortunately, I saw many cases where ADHD and ASD, autism spectrum disorder, seem to be the go-to diagnosis for so many cases where the proper formal assessments had not been conducted comprehensively or in any structured way or form. I remember this particular 16 or 17-year-old boy who had been given a diagnosis of ADHD, had a previous pre-existing diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder. And children with neurodevelopmental conditions like autism spectrum disorder are very... the brain sensitive to the effect of psychotropic medications. So you have to sort of, even if it's a 17-year-old, you have to start at a child's dose, because the brain will react and they tend to get more side effects very more easily. So, you have to be very careful. Now, with ADHD and stimulant medication treatment, I saw a number of cases like this, but this one I'm describing because it stood out and because the effects were so stark. The stimulant medication was prescribed, and stimulants have a tendency, if you don't have ADHD, you'll either persevere and have hyperfocus, or it'll just give you the side effects, but there'll be basically no improvement, etc. And if you haven't considered what are the possibilities in terms of diagnostics, this young person was misdiagnosed with ADHD. They had just ASD. So the stimulants prescribed made them agitated and aggressive, which the family described was completely out of character for this young boy. Seriously attacked the father, was agitated in the house, was described as not being typical of this young person. And then the dose was increased, thinking that this was ADHD and then, not responding to treatment sort of thing. And it got to the point where the young person ended up in an inpatient psychiatric unit because it was so risky towards others in the family at that point, and there were young siblings as well. And 6 weeks on, I think there was a reassessment, And it was found that there's no evidence to suggest ADHD. He was weaned off the stimulant medication, sent back home, a neurodivergent, a young person, you know. And that was that. A year or so down the line, the parents were again approached and convinced, or there was an attempt to convince to start stimulants. And they were restarted at the point at which I saw them. They were on stimulant medication. When actually the discharge summary clearly said there's no ADHD, you know, stop the stimulant medication, and it was stopped and things got better. Despite that, I mean, this is the sort of thing that doesn't, there's no logic in it.
You felt you weren't being listened to and you made that decision to go public with your concerns, Maya. Was that a difficult decision to go public?
Yes, I went public in 2021. I was in communication only with senior management. As I kept this, it was a bit of a minefield of discoveries through the year, and it was one after the other after the other. And in March there was a particular finding of a significant number of cases where not only had everything that I've described gone on, but they hadn't been seen in the CAMHS clinic from 2016 onwards. And their GPs were just repeat prescribing those medications.
Are you saying that these young people who are under the treatment of CAMHS, of South Kerry CAMHS, they had last been seen or assessed in 2016 and in 2021 they were still on the same medication?
They were. And
that's correct.
By chance that, sorry?
That's correct. Yes. So 5 years, there weren't any check-ins to see if the medication needed to be changed,
no,
if they need to be weaned off. They were on the same medication as had been originally prescribed 5 years earlier.
Well, certainly the antipsychotics were there. I mean, if I go case by case, then there might be some where one or two medications might have been stopped, or the young person's family might have decided we don't need this medication or whatever, or the GP might have advised. I don't know.
But there had been a number of instances that you came across.
55 cases. This was just by chance we got to find out, us as a team. In March 21, there was a phone call from a parent, from a mother who's 8-year-old, diagnosed with an autism spectrum condition, had called to ask if the evening dose of antipsychotic could be prescribed at 8 p.m. instead of 6 p.m. because it would help the young person sleep better and longer, etc. We used to run a duty or emergency rota. One of my colleague clinicians passed it on to me because it was a medication-related query. I spoke to the mum, It was a heart sink moment when I heard that the last time that the young person had been in the clinic was 2016, and I heard the dose about the risperidone being continued, and the call was just about changing the time from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. It went much deeper. In my head, I didn't want to alarm the mum, and I made an appointment immediately for the next day and said that a follow-up was very overdue. And I discussed that with the multidisciplinary team.
And when you said it to the team, what happened?
I mean, the team was aghast, and just as I was, it was a moment of, it was more than just shock. It was, like I said, it was a heart sink. I think we all simultaneously realized what might have happened, because other clinicians in the team also felt that there were files that might have been unaccounted for in the audits that were done yearly. Two clinicians actually, and one of the receptionists offered to come in on the following Saturday, go through all the files, 500 and something files over Saturday and Sunday. Did that, bless them, the hard work that they put in. And on Monday, I was informed that 55 files are found where the last audit date was 2016, and this young person's file was one of them. Because when I tried to find, after the parent had called me about the change of medication time, we tried to find the file and I couldn't find the file. So they were, in the filing room in some section which was for some reason left untouched, and that they weren't picked up for 4 years. And sometimes there were audit sheets, the green audit sheets in front of the files, many files, which year after year noted that follow-up review is overdue, follow-up review is overdue. So those were also there in the amongst the 55. So it's not like the system didn't know. Firstly, for 4 years, that team didn't have a consultant. And the North Kerry consultant was sort of providing some kind of informal cover as well. After I reported this finding, I offered a plan, a structured plan to kind of deal with this in the quickest way possible, etc. The team was behind it, and it spooked the senior management, and that I think was the trigger point. So I was identified as the bad apple, bringing bad news after bad news. No, the bad news existed. I just was the first person to sort of articulate that, look, this is harm, or this is clinical negligence, or this is both, or a young person is being put in harm's way when there's no, you know, it shouldn't be happening.
What did it feel like when you did blow the whistle?
I had been writing all the way to the chief officer and getting responses in writing. And then there was a look back review arranged with terms of reference, which I found were, and this may be controversial, and it is just my subjective view. The terms of reference were so narrow that in my subjective view, it almost amounted to minimization of the, you know, minimizing the findings, the incriminating findings.
Are you referring to the Maskey review?
The Maskey review was done as it should have been done, and also the Halpin review later, which validated the concerns I had raised.
So you've no issue with those reviews?
I should have clarified. The terms of reference for, in general, yes, were narrow for the Maskey review. And also, as clinicians, the whole team, we were invited for interviews about our experiences and whatever we wanted to share. I found whenever I tried to share context-based information, everything I said there was quoted as being, oh no, this is out of the terms of reference. I just couldn't find a way to communicate that, you know, X, Y, and Z, very serious things were happening. And I was losing confidence in the process. The parameters were so narrow, you can't give a meaningful account. And I understand Dr. Sean Maskey's perspective and his look back review team's perspective as well, because those are the terms of reference. You don't step out of them. So the bare bones were there. So 46 cases of serious harm, yes. But the flesh, the muscle and flesh of this matter was out of terms of reference.
Am I right in saying, Maya, you would have broadened the terms of reference with the Maskey report? Do you think, for example, that the time period should have been extended, covering the period that Maskey was looking into, which I think was from 2016 to 2020? Do you think that should have included more years?
It could have done. It would have found more such cases. But I'm referring specifically to the terms of reference of the look back review process, where what was disallowed or not within scope of the terms of reference could have been useful information that, if examined or allowed to be examined, might have yielded a greater number of young people seriously harmed than 46 of the 535 they were looking at, 1,500 files.
This is for South Kerry.
Yes, I had no involvement with North Kerry.
Maya, why do you want to return to Kerry after such a turbulent experience?
My focus has always been the young people and families. And Kerry is a community that I came to care about deeply. And I believe that with the right structures and safeguards in place, it is possible still to contribute positively and help somehow rebuild trust in services. I love Ireland. In the early days of my job in Kerry, in South Kerry, I absolutely love Killarney and the National Park and everything. You know, and
what do you love about Killarney?
It's very compact, but you have everything, and it is beautiful. And the National Park is just stunning. And I just felt settled. And even as early as September, October, I thought, yeah, I have no interest in conflicts and controversies. My intention was to bring to light what I brought to light and speak the truth, knowing fully well the consequences. And of course, I didn't expect the consequences to be that horrific. I still love Killarney. I still love Ireland. When initially breaking the news to the families, I managed to see and correct medications for, I think, about 250 young people. I couldn't get to all of them in 8 months. And towards the end, I was put on admin leave anyways, duties anyway. So my clinics were cancelled, so even shorter. And I would easily spend 2 hours, 3 hours with breaks in between for follow-up appointments. Initially, there was grief, there was anger, there was rage and frustration. And there was so much of it that, you know, it could have, if left uncontained, it could have led to a crisis. My decision ultimately is guided by professional duty. Everybody has a view about the whistleblowing. But I think people need to hear this very clearly. I did not whistleblow. I went through the senior management processes until I found that the minimization was happening in other ways. The moment I sort of reported that, that was a turning point for me. And that's when the aftermath truly began for me. Then I started to suffer. I resigned end of June 2021. Eventually, the resignation was accepted. I actually resigned in December for a few days, and then I was asked to sort of not resign and promised resources and this, that, which never came. But anyway, I stayed on. I resigned, and then I learned that the service had not managed to find any locum consultant to follow me. And so I sent an email desperately, really, stating six real high risks in a system which I had predicted was likely to experience a serious untoward incident. There was an SUI waiting to happen, a serious incident waiting to happen. And therefore, consideration should have been given to closing that particular service for some time to think about how patient safety can be guaranteed and not offering a service at all if it's not safe. It was one of hundreds of emails I'd written by then. I asked to rescind my resignation when I heard that there was no one to hand over my cases to, and there were still 250 waiting for correction of medication. My request was declined. Instead, I was told that my help could be used in another Cork-based service. Long story short, I resigned from the other service as well, and then started working in another county where I experienced numerous issues. Ultimately, I had to leave from there. Then I stopped getting posts in Ireland.
And now, Maya, your reinstatement to practice in Ireland, I should say, was due to be heard last week by an adjudication panel of the Irish Medical Council. If your reinstatement is successful, would you mind telling us about your plan to open a practice in Kerry, how it'll work?
That process is ongoing, although I will say with confidence it will be, I'm expecting a positive outcome. But as it is ongoing, I won't go into the specifics, but my focus would be to returning to safe, ethical clinical practice if the regulatory processes go through and re-registration is successful. I would hope to contribute through a service model that will prioritize careful assessment and appropriate prescribing and complete transparency with families. I understand that I am seen as a risk of reputational damage to organizations. It's a phrase I've heard far too many times now, surprisingly in the UK as well, and my reputation has been destroyed. I was just about to give up and sort of, you know, at one point I was cleaning toilets in a large hostel in London because the news had traveled to the UK about the whistleblowing and et cetera. So in interviews, I would get asked questions about, I mean, most interviews, at least half to three quarters of the content of the interview questioning was related to the ins and outs of my role in the whistleblowing in Ireland. I, of course, answered honestly and transparently. I would get locum jobs, but then the moment as a consultant, you are expected to notice patterns that indicate that, for example, patient safety is being compromised in ABC way. And you're expected to take leadership and articulate in the best interests of young people and families. And anything that I would say, there was a strange hypervigilance around me all the whole time in every job. And by that time, I had also started developing workplace-based PTSD, which was eventually diagnosed.
The Irish Mail on Sunday says that it's your hope, if you are re-registered with the Medical Council, your plan is to return to Kerry, as you said, and it would be on the basis of opening a private practice for children and teenagers and young people that would charge people on a sliding scale based on family income.
Scale.
So it all depends on how much you can pay. And would you like to be based in Killarney if all that goes to plan?
Absolutely. And I'm actually going to declare this, to be honest. I was waiting for the whole process to finish. I did get an email from the Medical Council yesterday. They had said they would get back in 1 to 2 weeks, but actually got back very early, saying that the panel has decided that I should be granted my registration. And now there's the bureaucracy of the paperwork. And yeah, so that'll take some weeks.
How does that feel, though, that you can come back to Ireland and practice again?
I haven't processed it yet. It took 2.5 years for this application to come through. But yeah, I mean, in parallel, the GMC, which I'm under voluntary health undertakings, which have prevented me from getting jobs in the UK as well.
And the GMC, is that the General Medical Council in the UK?
It is, yeah, the counterparts of the Irish Medical Council, but in the UK. So they are looking at, so I've done everything, complied with all the processes involved, and those undertakings are now being reviewed. And I just think about it's such an irony that I have no history of any sort of mental health difficulties pre-whistleblowing. And what I'm trying to do now is rebuild. Fundamentally, my core remains the same, but these experiences have gotten added on, and they are heavy. I have not named all the other adversities. So it never stopped for me after the workplace-based PTSD was diagnosed. It just snowballed from there, and it was relentless. I had no break between professional and personal traumas. I surrendered at some point. Now I'm trying to get my life back and rebuild now that things have finally started to move in the right direction.
You have revealed you've been living homeless in London. How is your living situation now?
Yeah, well, especially with the compensation monies, I was paid in October 2024.
Is this the lawsuit against the HEC for 75,000 euro that was settled?
Yeah, but then there was legal fees of 50,000 euros. That was the kindness of the solicitor concerned who decided to forego the fees. And so I had some money at that point, because before that I was using my savings and moving from hostel to hostel in London. And in October I went to India after receiving the compensation monies, and it helped because it would be cheaper to live there, because I've been unemployed since November 23 now. So it was enough for a year, and then that ran out. And of course then I had to ask for help from family, and there was an interview of the many applications I made for jobs in the UK that I was shortlisted for, came in September 2025. The interview was in person. You know, the ticket costs, etc., for flights, I had to borrow money from my family. I got the job. They were happy to accommodate all the restrictions on my practice put in place by the General Medical Council. 2 months of recruitment processes went ahead. And suddenly I'm in November, early November, I get an email. I'd cleared occupational health assessments. Start date was being discussed. And suddenly I saw that the trust had decided to withdraw the conditional offer of employment because of a difficulty with references.
Are you still homeless? Do you have somewhere to live at the moment in the UK?
I was homeless for a while. I had to sleep in a Heathrow airport for safety reasons. And then when I finished completely with the finances, and by the way, it's not like I did not apply for any non-medical jobs. I would go for jobs and I would be told that you're overqualified. And many rejections later, I just stopped doing that. Eventually, I had to approach the state for state welfare. So I approached the local council, and I was put first in charity, shelter. It's like a shelter place. Then moved to another, and then eventually I'm now in temporary accommodation for homeless people.
That's where you are at the moment. But hopefully that's all changing soon, and that you'll be able to come back to Kerry and to Clarny that you clearly love so much. Have former Kerry CAMHS patients and families, have they reached out to you? Do you feel you've gotten a lot of support from people in Kerry?
Well, that's the one thing that's kept me going, if anything. It's meant a great deal. Hearing from families who felt that their concerns are finally being recognised generally reinforces why speaking of matters. And so it reminds you that there are real people affected. And I have received a lot of genuine support and kindness, compassionate words of support and support in other ways. Without that, I think, I don't know, I would have at some point lost the motivation. And I don't know what I would have done, but changed careers. But
that
I'm
support
here.
Kept you going, do you think?
It did. I mean, I am malnourished because of chronic malnutrition, and I don't care about that. And it's been treated, of course. It's the psychological food provided by the families of Kerry and other places as well. That's at least in terms of motivation and resilience. It fed my resilience and kept me going for longer. I could see that this would hopefully end someday, and I wouldn't have been able to see that for that long. I mean, it's been years. If the support hadn't kept going. And I'm glad that things look like they might be resolving now, because the undertakings are also under review to see whether they should be rescinded or not. I'm hoping they'd be rescinded. In Ireland, I think it's just about going through the paperwork and the whatever processes are involved. They take time.
And we're speaking to Dr. Maya Sharma, the HSE consultant who exposed the Kerry CAMHS scandal, who revealed the inappropriate, in some cases, and excessive treatment of children and teenagers in child and adolescent mental health services in Kerry. May I ask your reaction to Minister of State for Mental Health, Mary Butler? She paid tribute to you for your role in bringing prescriptions and diagnostic concerns in Kerry to light. What's your response?
I appreciate the recognition. I think it's important that the role of raising concerns in good faith is acknowledged. I think more broadly, it highlights the need to ensure that the systems genuinely support both patient safety and those who speak up. The real test is how any kind of protections put in place work in practice. What's the saying with the pudding?
The proof is in the pudding.
I would say that is the case here. So in practice, whether clinicians feel safe to raise concerns early enough and whether those concerns are acted on constructively, and that's where meaningful change will happen. So I appreciate the recognition and the acknowledgement. I'm thankful to Minister Butler. A similar acknowledgement, but in writing from the ex-CEO of the HSE, Mr. Paul Reid.
Now, Maya, you said that your reputation as a whistleblower made it impossible to find work in any publicly funded health service, even though you had settled successfully that lawsuit against the HSE for €75,000. Now, the HSE has said and has given statements, for example, to the Irish Mail on Sunday and says it is committed to protecting from penalisation or a threat of penalisation whistleblowers because the workers made a protected disclosure. They say they're committed to protecting any worker from being undermined or penalised in some way because they've made a protected disclosure. Do you share Minister Butler's confidence that changes made by the HSE, including the establishment of that new National Office for Protected Disclosures, what are your feelings about the establishment of this office?
That's a difficult one because I can't predict the success or not of this office. There has to be complete transparency in the ways decisions are made and actioned. If there's no coherence in the protection offered, one office is not going to be able to do that because there are so many other interfaces to manage.
So you're welcoming the establishment of this national office, but you're saying ensuring that whistleblowers aren't penalised, that more is needed than merely establishing a new national office.
Yeah, it's a cultural thing as well. Liaison and not fragmentation is the key, plus complete transparency. So the whistleblower is protected completely. If this is not the case, then 10,000 offices later, no whistleblower will be ever protected.